Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Science Facts and Fallacies podcast brought to you by the Genetic Literacy Project. I'm your host, Cameron English.
And I'm your co-host, Kevin Fulta, a professor who cares about science communication.
This is the weekly show where we discuss the biggest stories from the Genetic Literacy Project to keep you informed about groundbreaking developments from the worlds of science and medicine, and of course, to help you separate facts from fallacies as you read the headlines. Hello, everybody. Welcome back. Science Facts and Fallacies podcast, episode 227. I am your host, as always. My name is Cameron English, joined again by Dr. Liza Dunn, world traveler. Liza, you got to tell me about this trip to the Middle East, because I've never been. What's it like?
It's fascinating. I was in Amman, Jordan for a conference, and I got to, the city is so amazing because of the amount of history that's there. Alexander the Great went through there. The Romans were there. Earliest Christianity was there. I got to see where Jesus was baptized in the River Jordan, which is really more of a creek than a river. Think of a raging river by John the Baptist. They also had Mount Nebo, which is where Moses was on top of this mountain looking over into the Promised Land. There's just such a rich, fascinating history. The Ottomans were there, and obviously now it's an Arab country, and it's just a really, really neat city and fascinating culture.
Yeah, that's super cool. I have to go sometime. I tend to be the person that likes to stay home. I travel when I have to, or, you know, when I get to go on vacation. But after I get home, I just have to huddle inside for like 4 days and recuperate, because it's pretty brutal. But it seems like you're very, very happy to be here and bright and shiny. So apparently it didn't have that effect on you.
No, it was wonderful. It was wonderful.
Very good. Okay.
Another thing that's cool about it really quick was it's right by Israel, and the Jordan River separates Israel from Jordan itself. And literally it's about 3 yards distance, the border. It's just incredible. And it's just this little creek between the two of them.
Yeah. Yeah, it's so crazy, because for us, that's so far removed from everyday existence. But then you go there and you go, oh, yeah, this is the place where all of this world-changing stuff happened. And it's
exactly,
just, it's
exactly
just,
right.
You know, it's like, it's just water and it's just dirt. But at the same time, you know, it's a significant part of the world. But crazy stuff.
The beginning of civilization was in the Middle East. So
yeah. 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 We'll have to talk more about that at some point, because it's relevant to a lot of the issues we cover on the show. But let's get into these stories, because I feel like we could just babble all day about about history in the Middle East and all that. So three stories, as always, really important stuff in the news. And we're going to have a lot to say, no doubt. So first up, with meat alternatives flourishing, people might eventually look back on meat eating much the way we view, and I'm not making this up, cannibalism and human sacrifice, says the Washington Post.
Oh my God.
Next up, a topic we've done many times. Safety of herbicide glyphosate reaffirmed again by the European Food Safety Authority, rejecting activist claims. And finally, the story that's in the news and is going to be probably for the next several years, aspartame spins the $25 billion wheel of misfortune. How the environmental activist, tort lawyer, money machine manipulates journalists, misleads policymakers, and scares the public, by our good friend John Antine at GOP. You can tell where he stands on this issue.
Yes.
Okay, so first story really caught my attention. Anytime someone compares anything to cannibalism and human sacrifice, that isn't cannibalism or human sacrifice, I go, okay, what's going on here? So this is a story by a journalist named Bina Venkataraman. I totally butchered her name. Very sorry about that. We'll just call her Bina for simplicity's sake. But she's making the case that as time goes on, we're going to become more ethical and more morally conscious, and we're going to look back on meat eating as a truly cruel endeavor, if you will. So she says, people often stop eating animals after they see some sort of media that highlights the intelligence of animals, or you know, their ability to love or to sacrifice for other members of their pack or whatever. So she brings up the example of the movie Babe in the early 1990s. It's this talking pig on a farm, and you know, it's adorable and it sings. And you know. And then I haven't seen it, but there's a documentary on Netflix about, I believe it was a diver or a fisherman or something who befriends an octopus.
Yep.
And they develop this really strong bond. And that is facilitating a lot of people, especially in, I don't know, bigger urban areas to eschew octopus as a meal choice. I've never had octopus. It's not something that occurs to me, but maybe that's, I'm the wrong class of person to consider eating octopus. But in any case, all she's saying is that as we're confronted by, I guess, supposed contradictions in how we behave and how we think, we go through these sort of contortions is the word she uses to try to make sense of and try to justify our behaviors that she at least says are contradictory or hypocritical. And then she turns to the issue of lab-grown meat, and she says this is going to facilitate this shift away, because we're looking for a way out of these contradictions, but we also want to preserve the way of life that we're familiar with. And she says that proponents argue that meat brewed from animal and egg cells in vats requires less land and water, and that it will one day be affordable, green, and tasty enough to obviate the need to raise and slaughter animals. Okay, so that's a very familiar case. There's lots to say here. She has a couple other arguments in here that I think we need to touch on, but I'm sure you have a lot of input here, Liza, so go for it.
Yeah, so first of all, for millennia, people were hunters and gatherers, and they've always eaten meat in some capacity or another. And meat's a really, really important component of the diet because you need protein for your brain to grow. And it's really, really kind of gotten animal livestock agriculture has gotten so much more efficient in the 20th and 21st century that you can actually be very, very efficient at getting high quality protein. And really, actually, if you think about it, it's the ultimate plant-based diet because they take grass that we can't digest in areas that can't grow things like fruits and vegetables and row crops and things like that. So areas that are difficult to grow things, and they concentrate that nutrient into very, very high quality protein that is really, really important for people. So we've co-evolved with animals, and in the wild, I'd like to point out that animals eat each other all the time. It's not a very, very pretty existence. If you see kind of how animals behave just as Mother Nature would have. Now, in terms of animal suffering, I think that everybody would like to make sure that animals are treated well. There's a lot of mythology about, you know, cattle raising and chickens and things like that. You know, cage free. There's this promotion of going cage free, that there's a notion that feedlots are really terrible places for cattle and that cattle are abused. If you don't treat your animals well and you don't give them good nutrition, they won't have adequate growth. So and they won't be as productive. So it is in the farmer's best interest to treat the animals as well as they can. And then they are, you know, you have a much smaller dairy herd now because you can make so much more milk. And so the animals are much more productive than they used to be. So going back to the, you know, good old days of hunting and gathering, people weren't just eating, you know, a plant-based diet. We need protein. We need vitamin B12. And so the discussion around the livestock industry is often, I think, misguided. The farmers treat their animals well. It's a really, really essential, important part of a protein diet. And I think that it's gotten so much more efficient that you can do much more with less. Now, turning to the lab-grown meat, I was actually at the Consortium of Universities for Global Health Conference in, I want to say it was probably 2017, and I saw some of the first discussions about lab-grown meat, and they brought in some ground beef, and it was $18,000 a pound, which is absolutely right. You can't do that. And the other thing about lab grown meat is it's, you know, people talk about highly processed food. This is a highly processed food. It is in food processing gets a bad rap. Food processing in general makes life easier for people to not have to, you know, go do all sorts of stuff in the kitchen themselves. But in this case, it's very highly processed and people don't tend to like the taste of it so much. And it's not doing anywhere near as well as they thought it would in terms of economically. So lab grown meat, I think, is going to be a little bit more of a pipe dream, especially as we are highly productive in our livestock management now. And I think that you get good quality protein in the diet, and it's very, very important. And animal welfare is important to the farmers. So I don't know if that kind of touches on everything. Oh, and one last thing. I don't know if you've seen this article. Plants, when they get eaten, when they get a bite out of them, they have a whole kind of nervous system of their own where glutamate, which is an excitatory neurotransmitter, gets released, and it sends this cascade of signaling calcium ions goes down into the plants, and they signal other plants by releasing, you know, it's not really a pheromone, but really releasing a chemical signal. So technically, they're screaming while they're being eaten too. So we can't get away from people. That's how you know animals survive in the wild. That microorganisms coexist and they compete for things and they eat each other up. And so it's just the circle of life, and it's putting a whole moral thing on it is difficult because you don't want to have people starve to death either. So yeah,
there's so much to get into. As I was reading this, what really frustrates me about a lot of the press coverage I see today, especially if it's like an op-ed at a newspaper, is there's not so much an argument that the person is right. There's just more of an assumption that they're right. And it's incumbent upon the reader to go, well, yeah, you know, what do you think? Because I'm right. It's like, it's this really obnoxious thing. And I just want to, there's so many issues that this touches on. But like, for example, I would love to ask the author, what do you think about physician-assisted suicide? What do you think about abortion? What do you think about war? You know, what justifies us going to another part of the world and dropping bombs on a country?
Exactly.
How many innocent people are we allowed to kill in the name of whatever the cause is, right? So let's see who's really got some contradictions in their thinking here. Because you seem to be starting, she seems to be starting with this premise that it's just self-evidently obvious that animals should have the same rights that humans do. And that we can't pick and choose which animals we eat and which ones we raise as pets. And I have a response to that. My first answer is, well, why? You know, you make the case to me that the way, you know, most of humanity has lived for most of its history is wrong. You know, Washington Post contributor living on the coast somewhere. You know, okay. You tell me why everyone else needs to change to suit your really idiosyncratic beliefs. Yes. I'd like an answer to those questions. Another thing is that, you know, we hear a lot today about, you know, this is my truth and I'm living my best life and this is my experience and, you know, who are you to judge me? And then all of a sudden, everyone has this real commitment to objective facts and rational thinking. And let's really think through these arguments for meat eating. And you know, so it's like, we're just supposed to flip back and forth, right? So on this issue, you know, it's my truth. You only live once, whatever. But on this issue, it's like, hold on, let's get the microscope out and let's go through this with a fine tooth comb. It's it's just silly. Anyways, what else did you think?
Oh no, I thought it was interesting. I think that agriculture in general gets a bad rap, and it's unfortunate because it is critical for civilization. And when we were talking about the Middle East, that's where civilization was born, and it was born 10,000 years ago because of agriculture. And it makes people's existence possible. And I think it's very short-sighted. We're almost cutting our noses off despite our faces to call for a return to a sort of utopian vision of what life was like prior to the 20th century. And yes, you're exactly right. People have been, you know, going in battles and wars and doing all sorts of things for millennia. And it doesn't necessarily make a war and all of that right, but human survival is critical. And I would like to see good quality agriculture going forward for at-risk countries. I was at this meeting that I had in Jordan, I was meeting with regulators from all over Sub-Saharan Africa and, in the Middle East. And Sub-Saharan Africa has very, very food insecure people. And the tribes that you see there, so like the Maasai who are in Kenya, and they're in the Maasai Mara Game Park, which is attached to the Serengeti. They're cattle herders. And so they live largely off of milk and blood. And they take very good care of their cattle. But so cattle are a huge cultural part of other people's lives. And Western sensibilities don't reflect the reality that we have just such an incredible abundance of food that we can be having these discussions about who should be doing what.
Yeah. I went off on a philosophy-tinged rant there, but let me bring it back to the science of this, because I think that is really important, because for as nonsensical as I think this isn't a solution yet for feeding the world. It's just not. And our mutual friend Allison Van Inenum at UC Davis wrote an article about this for GLP some years ago. And one of the points she made is that we're trying to spend millions of dollars in these bioreactors and fine tune them so they'll produce a nutritious source of protein. And nature has already given us that. And she says, it's called a cow, right? It's like, as you were just saying, they take the grass, they take the stuff we can't eat, they turn it into a very nutrient-dense source of food. And it's
and they're a critical part of the ecosystem,
yeah,
right? Because they fertilize the soil, they make the soil very, very rich. I don't know if you've ever heard of Frank Mittlener.
Oh yeah.
So he talks about greenhouse gas emissions. Well, if you can have rich soil, you can sequester carbon. So sequestering carbon, they're part of this whole cycle. They get this bad rap, but they're part of this whole cycle. And we are so much better at raising cattle now than we were before that it takes less water, less grass, less corn, less of everything to make a much higher quality steer than we used to.
Yeah, it's like your rotary phone versus your smartphone, to use a comparison I brought up a couple weeks ago. It's the same thing. It's technology and innovation, and primarily smart people who figure this stuff out. They allow us to do things more efficiently and at a lower cost as a result. And all of this is another thing that frustrated me about the story. All of these details and all of this context is just totally removed from the question, and it's this simple black and white moral issue again. In this case, black and white objectivity is okay. But it's a very simple, like in her mind, this isn't that hard of an issue. And I don't think that's correct. And one other example, she talks about livestock's major contribution to the worsening climate crisis. As we've said before, what do you think is going to happen to the climate when we have to plant a bunch more, like a buttload more plants to feed ourselves, right?
Yeah, you would have to take almost every acre of arable land out there, deforestation. Oh, speaking of deforestation, that livestock gets also slammed in Brazil for deforestation. The claim is that the cattle farmers are cutting down the forest for the Amazon rainforest for livestock, for cattle. And actually, the government has very strict rules in Brazil. There is a certain percentage of the land that is used for livestock, and you cannot deforest the rainforest for livestock. So that's a misconception. And if you have the same amount of land, what you want to do is you want to wind up making your cattle breeding more, breeding for the most efficient kind of cattle. And in the United States, let's see, in the 60s and 70s, we began breeding better, meaning bigger animals. And they're far, far more advanced than they were 20 or 30 years ago. So the second factor is they've cut back on the time needed to raise cattle. In the 1970s, it took 609 days to raise a cow from birth to slaughter. Today, it's 485 days. And so that, and that's because they are treated better, they're fed better, they get a better existence, right? And so everything that they do is so much more efficient, and that decrease in time actually means that there's decreased inputs to raise the same or more protein. Now, if you want to talk about inputs, the amount of electricity and the amount of sort of extra inputs that you need to make lab-grown beef is why it's $18,000 a pound, or it was then. Obviously, it's on the shelves, so it's a lot cheaper now, but it's still out of range for a lot of people in terms of price. And when people try it, they don't necessarily like it very much.
Yeah, so many good points there. Let me add on to one. This is from Dr. Hannah Ritchie. She's an environmental scientist. She's one of the leaders at Our World in Data, and they put out all these great articles just documenting, you know, where do we stand with certain like global problems like climate change and deforestation and stuff. Here's what she writes on this website. She says, the world passed peak deforestation in the 1980s, and it has been on the decline since then. We lost 150 million hectares, an area half the size of India, during that decade. Since then, deforestation rates have steadily declined to 78 million hectares in the 90s, 52 million in the early 2000s, 47 million in the last decade. So in other words, deforestation is very rapidly, you know, on in terms of total history, is declining, right? It's almost gone. And it's happening in part because of the improvements in agriculture you mentioned. Yeah. But we get wealthier and we figure out how to feed ourselves and how to not freeze to death. And then we go, well, we should cut down all these trees. Let's work on that, right? That's exactly what's happening. And this is the sort of stuff, I can't stand it, Liza. It always gets overlooked. It's like these reporters just sit down at their desk and they go, oh, you shouldn't eat octopus. Let me tell you why I'm so much. It's like, just shut up. You don't know what you're talking about. I'm sorry. Sorry, everybody.
So the stats that I was reading were from Judith Kapper, and it's feedlot beef better for the environment? So you should go look at that article because it's really good. It dispels a whole lot of mythology about livestock farming.
We're getting better at it. It's great. What else did I want to talk about here that kind of, this is just me speculating, but like the thought of you comparing eating a cheeseburger to sacrificing a child to the weather gods to, you know, I don't know. Like the thought of, I read about that stuff in history sometimes and it sends a shiver down my spine. The fact that like parents would take a young child and burn it to death.
Yes. That's appalling. It's appalling. Right. But, you know, cannibalism is still practiced in some parts of the world. And it's actually how we discovered what the etiologic agent for CJD, Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, was. Because of the 4IA tribe in Papua New Guinea were eating each other, and their spinal cords carried this prion that ate holes in their brains. So, yeah, we prefer not to have cannibalism. It's just, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, the other thing, finally, I know we're spending a lot of time on the story, everybody, but I think this is probably it's the most novel one we've dealt with this cannibalism claim. She talks about, we're losing species of fish and we're like, it's just so apparent that this is bad because we're eradicating these species. I don't think that's the case. And I think, and again, not deforestation, but overfishing is a real problem.
Yep.
There's no denying that. But I think the theme on the show and for a lot of people in this kind of science communication world that you and I inhabit is we come up with solutions to stuff. You know, when you read the press and you read a lot of activist groups, the answer is always the same. The answer is you have to fundamentally change your lifestyle and give us all your money and then everything will be fine. That's always the answer. The answer is never, Well, let's engineer a fish that grows faster and uses less feed that we can raise in land-based tanks. No. You may not, because I saw Anaconda once and I'm scared. You know, it's like, whatever. Okay, I'm done.
Yes, no, that's great. I mean, the whole kind of aqua bounty salmon, right? Yeah. You don't want to overfish the salmon that are, you know, in the Pacific Northwest. So you come up with a solution to it and everybody's like, oh, you can't do that. Yeah. You don't want to use pesticides on crops so much. So you come up with a solution to that. No, you can't do that. So it's problematic.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and again, we'll move on after this. And this kind of ties into the glyphosate story. That's because it's not about improving the environment in these discrete ways. It's about changing the way everybody lives. And that's all there is to it. And they're very clear about this. If you go read their literature, a lot of it is old and they don't put it on their homepage if they're Greenpeace. But if you go read the books that were written back in the day about deep ecology and, you know, we're just sort of one species among many in this great life. And we're all overseen by Mother Earth. You know, Gaia loves us. It's crazy. These people are crazy. All right.
If nature had her way, most of us would not be here. And they certainly wouldn't be writing books.
Okay. All right. Let's talk about glyphosate. Again, so this is, we've talked about this before. I believe it was a couple of years ago now, the European Food Safety Authority, or rather, I guess it's just the European Union. Periodically, they review, like we do too, they periodically review the pesticides that they have registered for use in agriculture. And they just look at the literature that's come out, the evidence that's been produced since they first approved the pesticide. And they look at everything, every possible risk, reproductive toxicology, carcinogenicity, anything, right? Impacts on brain health and mental health. Like, it's absurd. It's an extensive literature review. It's thousands upon thousands of studies. That's why it takes so long to produce these. So I think I wrote an article about it at the time. They had just announced that they were doing it, and they had announced the conclusions, and they hadn't published the report. Because they're like, we're still putting this thing together. It's going to be like 800,000 pages or something. Or 11,000, excuse me. It was 11. Massive document. So that's really all there is to say. I'm sure you can add some specifics here, but yeah.
Yeah, once again, glyphosate is the most important, in my mind, the most important chemical in the world that nobody really kind of realizes how it impacts our everyday life. It's hugely, hugely useful in that it's got a very low toxicity profile. It is has been out on the market for, we're pushing close to 50 years now. And so this is probably the most studied chemical out there. If there were some signal that it was causing harm to humans, we would see that by now, because it is such an important chemical. And the question becomes, how much more do you want us to do to help society see this? There are allegations that, you know, companies and regulatory agencies are intertwined, and that the company has undue influence on the regulatory agency. But I often ask people about this, about pharma and about you know, ag. You all claim that business is not trustworthy. Okay, so how would you get a product from the bench to the bedside? You clearly want to have some regulation in there. And what does that regulation look like? And so people want all these rules around it, and then the companies actually follow the rules for doing toxicity studies, environmental studies, those studies for ag anyway, for a pesticide, will take 10 years to do. The studies are audited. They are, the test methods are validated. Any adverse outcome in an animal must be reported to the regulatory agencies, like the EPA, for example. The EPA can come in to any time during that 10 years and review, look at your lab and make sure everything's right, look at your books, and they can shut you down if you're not compliant with good laboratory practice. So these are very rigorous studies, and the studies are done that way so you can get reproducibility for it. Now, glyphosate is cheap. It came off patent in 2000. So six other registrants, six other companies make it, and they conducted their own battery of studies, right, that show this same thing, that it is not a carcinogen, it's not a sensitizer, it doesn't cause reproductive harm, it doesn't cause endocrine disruption. So this is over and over and over again, a multitude of studies show the same thing. And so the question becomes, what are you going to believe? When the International Agency for Research on Cancer looked at glyphosate, they looked at an incomplete group of studies that were already looked at by the regulators and all the other studies on top of it. So this is taxpayer-funded precaution that is the precautionary principle is damaging here, because it actually impacts food security for people. It impacts farming at farmers, and it actually disproportionately affects the developing world too. You know, for example, Sri Lanka banned glyphosate in 2015 because of an allegation that turned out not to be true, that glyphosate was associated with kidney disease. And you'd think that if we'd seen that, we'd see that all over the place. We don't. And there is a kidney disease of unknown origin, but it's not related to glyphosate. Tea is Sri Lanka's major export. And it pays, according to the Food and Agricultural Organization, it pays for 71% of their food imports. And the tea plantations were so harmed. Sri Lanka is a tropical island. If you can't weed, the jungle grows into your tea plantations, bringing all sorts of things along with it, like snakes, for example. And imagine yourself hand weeding the jungle and coming across a cobra or a crate. And the World Health Organization said in 2017 that snake bite was one of the leading neglected causes of morbidity and mortality in the developing world, and it's related to agriculture. So young, healthy workers die and leave their children orphans, or get completely incapacitated by snake bite in the developing world. And so that's why it's really, really important to give them access to the tools that we have in the West to be able to farm well. So back to Sri Lanka. So, you know, young Tamil women hand weeding the jungle, they had a huge impact. Tea grows on trees. And so if the trees die, you have to grow the whole tree again before you are productive, right? So it had such a devastating financial impact on the farms, economic impact on the farms, that they went back and looked at it and said, well, no, maybe we need to reinstate glyphosate. So it got reinstated in Sri Lanka in 2018. Unfortunately, the government decided, at the advice of people like Vandana Shiva, to go all organic overnight in April of 2021, and the whole country collapsed because of bad agricultural policy. So the thing about glyphosate is that it's only being there's suspicion because of the three cases against glyphosate, that there's an the rest of the world thinks, oh, there were three cases where there were multi-million dollars awarded to by juries to litigants, and therefore there's got to be something wrong with glyphosate, because how would that happen? And that's just a feature of the American tort system. It's not that there's actually anything wrong with glyphosate. And the problem is that what it's done is it's made people have to have taxes paid to do and redo studies and, looking at a chemical that we know more about than probably any other chemical in the world. And I think it's just really, really unfortunate.
Excuse me. Mm-hmm. Yes, it's tragic. I mean, because this costs people their lives, and yes, it makes people suffer. There's no way around that. I think one thing we should talk about for a minute is this idea of regulatory capture, because when you bring up research like this, you say, I could map out the conversation, right? Here's an 11,000 page review of every piece of data you could possibly want to look at. Well, I don't trust the EFSA because they're captured by Bayer and Syngenta. And same thing with the EPA, right? The agriculture industry owns every regulator and they're not telling me the truth. No. Okay. But here's why that's wrong. Like, the idea of regulatory capture is very real. There are political appointees in charge of these federal agencies. Let me give you a very recent example of how absurd this gets. The CDC came out and said that men can breastfeed babies.
Yes. See, right?
One of the reasons this is so ridiculous, besides the fact that it's an obvious affront to human nature, is that one of the drugs people have to take to stimulate milk production if they're not pregnant is illegal. And it's discouraged by experts because it doesn't work very well. So you can't get it in the United States. Nonetheless, the CDC comes out and says, just take hormones that might or may not, you know, severely injure your child and may or may not work, you know, but hey, social justice must prevail, right? So with that kind of stuff in the news, I get why people look at an issue like this and they go, I just can't trust the EPA is telling me the truth. But I think the difference here is we have 40, 45 years of research and real world experience, right? Go talk to the farmers that use this and they go, I'm fine. I've been using this for 30 years, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, one other point that brings up is if you look at people with the highest glyphosate exposure, that would be farmers and pesticide applicators, their rate of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, which is the cancer everyone is freaking out about, is actually slightly lower than the background rate of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And these lawsuits do not involve anybody who works in agriculture. They're all consumers. I think the one sort of exception is the gentleman from San Francisco who did groundskeeping for a public school. He's the only, and even he does not have as high of an exposure as the people that have been studied by the EPA and by all kinds of different labs and all kinds of different companies. So all that to say, the evidence is how you adjudicate this. You don't say, well, I don't like the EPA, because frankly, I don't like them either. But you just look at the evidence and you figure out how to assess it. It's hard to do sometimes, but it's doable. And there's no reason to worry about this chemical in this case.
There is no reason to worry about the chemical. And the question is, how much more, what can we do that after all of these studies, after over decades and decades and decades, what can we do to reassure the public that this is not an issue?
I don't know. Our friend Jeffrey Cabot, cancer epidemiologist, pointed out a couple of years ago, we've run out of ways to study this. We can't do anymore. Like we've done so many, you couldn't conduct a new study. Like, you'd have to invent a new methodology because it's been studied so many different ways, you know? So I don't know. It's I am alarmed to see how persistent this issue has been. It's been since 2015, since the IARC monograph came out, and we're still talking about it. I guess the only hope at this point is the courts are going to keep saying no thanks.
Yeah.
Stupid, right? Because pretty soon you have some real precedent, and then the lawyers will get the hint and they'll just stop bringing these cases.
Yeah, we've been in the last five or six cases now, and you know, that never made the news.
Yeah, it's not as prominent for sure. There's a couple of news stories, but as a rule, reporters like to tell the Aaron Brockovich story over and over and over. And when they don't get to tell that story, it's boring and they're like, okay, so.
You know. Yeah, that's right.
Jury has common sense, on to next story, you know, that kind of thing. This next one, though, again, lots of similar themes here talking about aspartame. This is John Entine, but he's the publisher of Genetic Literacy Project. He wrote this this article. It's a really, John is such a great journalist because he will sacrifice a short, snappy title to tell people what the article is actually about. I love it. It's really good because he writes it's really hard hitting as far as the headline goes, but it also tells you everything. So he says, aspartame spins the $25 billion wheel of misfortune, how the environmental activist tort lawyer money machine manipulates reporters, misleads policymakers, and scares the public. Beautiful, John. Love it. It's so detailed. Yeah. It's great. Just a quick overview here. He talks about the two UN agencies that have come out or they're about to come out with separate reports on the carcinogenicity of aspartame, which is this non-nutritive sweetener that's used in all kinds of foods. One of them is IARC, of course, which has no particular expertise or reason to be doing this except to give lawyers a reason to file lawsuits. The other one is a body of bona fide experts that the UN assembles to look specifically at this question. So John points out that two things are all but certain to happen. The agency that looks at this issue and has the appropriate expertise is going to say there's nothing wrong here. 40 or so years of research, there's nothing to suggest this is a problem. IARC is going to come out and say, or it has already at this point, and said this is a possible carcinogen. We can talk more about that classification or what it actually means in a minute. And then he says the next thing that's going to happen, there's going to be a firestorm of media controversy. It's going to be in the headlines. And then the lawsuits are going to start appearing in probably the more liberal courts around the United States, where the law firms have predicted, and sometimes correctly, that they're more likely to get a favorable judgment either from a panel of judges or from 12 jurors. And so here we are now, again, with another issue. What do you have to say here?
This is the glyphosate redux, right? This is wash, rinse, repeat. I think somebody said, did you say that earlier? You might have said that earlier. But it's unfortunate because the you're pitting two World Health Organization agencies against each other, right? And one of them is a cancer hazard evaluator that, once again, does not look at the whole body of literature around any kind of chemical. Their classification of it as a possible carcinogen doesn't even trigger Prop 65 in California, right? So Prop 65 in California, you will see, for those of you who've been to California, you will notice that everything around you causes cancer, including walls and washing machines and everything, right? So they'll have a sign. This substance is known to the state of California to cause cancer or birth defects. That comes from Prop 65. And you have to fall into the probable carcinogen category to trigger Prop 65. And as far as I understand, possible carcinogen doesn't fall into Prop 65. IARC has looked at over 1,000 chemicals in its existence and has only come up with one, caprolactam, which is a stretchy stuff in yoga pants that is not a carcinogen. And everything else is either they've got this nondescript category now, but possible, probable, or definite carcinogen. And when you just throw the word in there, people get very, very upset. Now, aspartame is a very simple molecule that when you ingest it, it gets metabolized to two amino acids. Amino acids are the building blocks of proteins, and proteins make up the structural components and the machinery in your body. And so you can't live without proteins. But it's like having these, they're ingredients for proteins. So phenylalanine and aspartic acid is what it gets broken down into. And so to make the claim that amino acids are going to cause cancer, which I think they actually get a little bit more nuanced than that, but it's just blatantly false. And it's unfortunate because this, once again, very safe. It's safe for consumption. This very safe chemical that's been on the market that we were talking about this last time we talked about it, diabetics are able to have soft drinks and kids are able to have, you know, sweet things at parties and things like that they wouldn't be able to, you know. So, you're not going to drink like 36 cans in one setting of a diet soda, you'll explode. So I just think it's really, really unfortunate that this is the amount of hay that's being made over this. And once again, taxpayer dollars are going to go into some big regulatory apparatus to try to, you know, review stuff that we already know. And, you know, 5 years later, 6 years later, we'll be still looking at this and we'll have an 11,000-page report from EFSA saying it's okay. Right? We'll be still having this conversation.
One thing that's often helpful when these issues come up is just to look at the other things that IARC rates as possible and probable carcinogens. So at one point, coffee was a possible carcinogen.
Yep.
Tylenol, acetaminophen. That didn't go through. And the coffee one, and this speaks to another important point, California at one point was proposing to add coffee to the list of Prop 65 chemicals, which would have enabled all sorts of lawsuits, which could have very, very possibly risked, you know, certain coffee chains pulling out of the state or close, you know, what, you know, and that caused a public uproar because people were like, wait a minute, even in California, and people here are odd ducks, many of them, and they believe strange things about science, but even they were like, whoa. Right. I need my Starbucks on the way to work. How else am I supposed to tolerate this traffic? Right. So all of a sudden, you know, and it wasn't really the science that shut that down. It was just enough people going, coffee, really?
You know? They're making the same claims about of cell phones. They're saying that cell phones don't have ionizing radiation. Ionizing radiation is what causes tumors, not your cell phone. So, I mean, it's just, and I guess I don't know how to, they make all these claims, and I guess people have not picked up on the cell phone thing quite so much. Some people are, I think RFK Jr. even said on Joe Rogan the other day that Wi-Fi causes cancer. Joe's like, there goes your job, right? You're totally dependent on Wi-Fi. We've been totally dependent on Wi-Fi. So people will not take that claim as seriously as they will take a claim about a chemical that they don't know about.
Yeah, it's a very good point, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, frustrating.
Yeah. I think, though, that might be the silver lining to this awful situation we're in, is that when you, and again, we've talked about this a lot, it's usually when, you know, people experience an outbreak of a vaccine-preventable disease, all of a sudden the parents go, oh, you know, maybe I need that MMR shot after all, right?
Yeah.
Or whatever. You know, that's really what inspires the change, is people get sick and it affects their day-to-day life, and all of a sudden they're not scared of science as much. Yeah. So I think that might happen here. And I forget who it was on Twitter, but someone we both follow pointed out that I'm not seeing as much hysteria in the news and in my social media feeds about aspartame. And I think you were one of the people who pointed out, well, yeah, that's because everyone uses it, right? It's in syrup and diet soda and food, and it's just everywhere. It's just a part of everyday life. And so people have a harder time swallowing this concept of, am I really going to get cancer if I sweeten my coffee with this instead of sugar? You know, it just doesn't.
That's exactly right. And once again, we're living an extra 35 years. Then, you know, diet soda has been on the market since what, the 60s, a Tab or something like that. You remember the drink Tab?
Oh, yeah.
So diet soda has been on the market for a very, very long time. So I think that if we were seeing actually, you know, a big increase in a certain kind of cancer, then you could say that there was an association, but we're not seeing that, right? And the data don't show that. So it's people have been, we're living longer now than we did in the 40s and 50s. So it's not a good association.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm looking through John's story here. This is really good, everyone. Go read this, because he talks about the possible carcinogen classification and what it means and what it doesn't mean. And then he talks about these competing agencies and what they're actually saying.
Yes.
And he talks
about the joint partnership between FAO and WHO, which is tasked with looking at food safety, They're the regulators that know everything, that like look at all this hard stuff, right? And they look at all of the data, and they are the ones that are supposed to be regulating this. IARC is not even a regulatory agency. They have no regulatory capability. They just weigh in with an opinion that gets printed in the Lancet, and then the Lancet then goes and runs with it in the doctors. And I'll tell you, as soon as that leak came out, which was kind of interesting, that they leaked this first, as opposed to letting the agencies, they were supposed to have the information quarantined until they had agreed upon time. And I think it was yesterday, July 14th, was when they were supposed to come out and have the discussion, but the IARC findings got leaked first. And so that goes to the Lancet, and then the Lancet makes these claims, and doctors all are like, duh, this is a carcinogen. And so I've been talking to a bunch of doctors on Twitter going, it gets metabolized to amino acids. Oh, really? And so So when they see something like The Lancet publishing the summaries of the monographs on glyphosate, on aspartame, they think that the claims are legit. In the case of glyphosate, the Lancet has put it in the wrong class of chemicals and never retracted it. So, but you'd have to know something. I mean, if you're taking care of hypertension and diabetes and all these diseases all day long, you don't have time to go look into the regulatory literature around a topic. You take for granted that what the Lancet is telling you is truth. And then when it turns out not to be, it has a huge influence on the medical world.
Our your colleague and my friend Cammie Ryan is a social scientist, but she's pretty sharp when it comes to toxicology. And I saw, I think it was a couple of years ago now, there was some physician saying, this is a carcinogen and it's an organophosphate, glyphosate. I mean, it's this deadly chemical, and we need to be aware of this so we can treat our patients, blah, blah, blah. And Cammie jumped in. She goes, it's not an organophosphate. It's organophosphonate. It's a different class of...
That's exactly
and the,
right.
And the guy, to his credit, I believe, he's an MD, he responded and he said, I'm such an idiot. I'm so sorry. I looked at that word. It's obviously not the same thing. Thank you for the correction. But I think that nicely illustrates your point that this stuff goes out and there are physicians that treat real patients that are misled by this stuff.
Yes, they give it. So they put patients on escalating doses of a drug called atropine, which is an anticholinergic drug is what it is. And it's got a side effect profile that is not good. And these patients do not need to be on that to treat their overdoses if they take a glyphosate overdose. But it's leading to malpractice because it's never been retracted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this has been pointed out. You've pointed out, Cameron's pointed out, I wrote an article for ACSH pointing it out. Lots of people have said you're fundamentally wrong. Like you've classified this as the wrong chemical. Stop it. And they're like, meh.
And they're like, so what?
Yeah. Yeah. It's outrageous. Okay. Well, let's leave it there because we'll keep going for another couple hours, I'm certain. But we'll be back next week with a fresh batch of stories. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Dr. Liza MD, at CamJ English. Genetic Literacy Project is at Genetic Literacy. They put this on for us, so please give them a follow. Thank you so much, and we'll see you next week for episode 228.
Thank you. Have a good weekend.